Hello and welcome to the Depot Podcast. My name is Amanda Witt, and today we have a special live episode recorded in collaboration with Fourth Space, a experiential and immersive art and technology lab located at the Sir George Williams campus of Concordia. Our guest today is Fred Burrell. You'll hear from him in a moment. Yeah, here it goes. Thank you, Anna. And thank you so much to Fourth Space for having us today. My name is Amanda Marie Witt. I am a master's student in history here at Concordia. My pronouns are they, them in English, and I use feminine pronouns in French. I'm the current student coordinator of the Depot podcast. And so first, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about what Depot is. So it is the Deindustrialization and the Politics of Our Time initiative. It's a SHRC-funded project consisting of 33 partner organizations and 24 co-applicants and collaborators from Italy, France, Germany, the UK, Canada, and the United States. The partnership examines the historical roots and lived experiences of deindustrialization and the political responses to it. Its goal is to understand deindustrialization in a national or comparative perspective, its causes, the responses to it, its effects, and its legacies. The partnership joins 25 leading industrial museums, heritage groups, trade unions, labor archives, indigenous organizations, and publishers. The partnership's overarching objectives are fourfold. One, to understand the long-term consequences of deindustrialization and the underlying reasons for the rise in populist movements in Western Europe and North America in order to better understand our political conjecture. To situate the regional and local experience of deindustrialization within a wider transnational framework, to consider how race, gender, and the environment and settler colonialism structure and otherwise get bound up in the class politics of deindustrialization. Should be able to say that word better by now, huh? And forge connections between the leading researchers and partners in deindustrialization studies across borders to create a transnational community of practice where the next generation of deindustrialization researchers is nurtured and connected across borders. The Depot podcast aims to be a showcase for this new generation of researchers and also to provide content that introduces concepts and conversations happening within the deindustrialization studies to a broader audience. The podcast can be seen as both a record of these changing ideas as well as a site for public history. As with any project that is done using technology like these, it's always important for us to recognize what voices will be included and what voices will not. Today we are speaking with Fred Burrell, a postdoc at Cape Breton University and affiliate with the Center for Oral History and Digital Storytelling, who splits his time between Cape Breton and Montreal. His PhD work involved countless hours of oral history interviews, exploring the intersection of deindustrialization and gentrification along Montreal's Lachine Canal. He is active in tenants' rights movements and migrant justice organizing. Today we will be speaking about the ways that public-facing history can be part of activism and also in ways that it sometimes isn't. And now finally, Fred, I would love for you to introduce yourself. Tell me how you got to Montreal and why you stay.
Sure, I grew up in Nova Scotia. in a very small place called Upper Muscadabit with about 400 people. And I sort of had a burning desire to live somewhere larger and different. And I came to Montreal in 2005 to study at McGill, to do my undergrad there. And you know, I got involved very quickly in a variety of radical movements here in the city. Initially in sort of student movement stuff, and then in the neighborhood where I was living in Saint-Henri, down in the southwest of the city, around tenants' rights, the resistance to gentrification, which is one of the things we'll talk about today, and never left. It became my home, and I worked for a long time as a tenant organizer at the Popée, which is the tenants association in Saint-Henri. And I eventually decided that I would come back and do my PhD, which I did here at Concordia with Stephen High. I'm excited to be back in Nova Scotia at Cape Breton University, where I'm working with Lachlan McKinnon, who's another one of the partners, the co-investigators in the Depot research partnership. And so I'm sort of like rediscovering what it is to live in two places at once. But Montreal is always the center of my existence. Yeah.
Great. So in your PhD acknowledgement, you talk about how your parents were a very big influence on your organizing. And so I'd love to hear more about how maybe like your childhood and also your experiences with them informed that.
Sure. As I said, where I grew up, is a very small place. My dad was the United Church minister in our village. And my mom was a music teacher. And so I think they were doing forms of activism that are not, maybe not immediately recognizable as such. Because, you know, it was a place where heavily industrial, but no real tradition or institutions around labor organizing. No sort of like community infrastructure in a lot of ways that we would recognize in an urban context. But, you know, our sort of family life was about supporting the people in the community and organizing for, you know, recognition of basic needs and kind of equality on footing with urban contexts in Nova Scotia. And so, you know, I when I was 18 and I was moving to Montreal, I thought, okay, now I'm really gonna, you know, like discover what it is to be like a real activist. But I actually found myself, you know, as I was getting involved in stuff in Saint-Henri and recreating a lot of the things, you know, that I had seen my parents do when I was younger, just in a kind of a different context, in a different language, but that same kind of community spirit and also drive for fundamental transformation around people's basic material needs. Yeah.
Amazing. And then with learning this second language, you're learning kind of as you're doing this work. And so I wonder how that affects maybe how that vocabulary is built. And, you know, sometimes when we talk about languages, we talk about them as a formation of how we understand the world. So I wonder if there's an element of learning a language and getting involved in this, like in an urban context at the same time, that might've influenced.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I moved to Montreal, not really speaking much French. I had sort of like Trudeau French, from public school. It was very important to me to be able to communicate with my neighbors around me, and also to be able to like fully participate in the movements in the city, which is hard to do if you don't speak French, if you can't at least follow a conversation. So you know, it required like a multi-year commitment to sort of like feeling a bit not up to speed in a lot of things. It's definitely, you know, it's funny, like, as you say, the way you learn things is sort of shaped by the linguistic context that you're in. So, you know, for many years, I could sort of have, like, deep, intense conversations about, like, housing policy in French, but I couldn't say, like, pass the salt, you know? It's like, so those, like, basic sort of daily life stuff. But, I feel like I'm pretty caught up now. But, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. I look forward to a day where I can have any full conversation in French, working on it.
You'll get there.
I was also thinking about this idea of the dual identity of being both essentially a gentrifier moving into a neighborhood like this that is experiencing deindustrialization and also has experiencing kind of this, like, displacement of the existing residents, while also yourself maybe not being someone who has a lot of choice in where they live either, but is kind of part of that, like, educated kind of new class of underpaid academics, et cetera.
Yeah, totally. I mean, when I moved here in 2005, and I was living on student loans. I didn't have much money. I moved into an apartment in Saint-Henri with 5 other roommates, didn't know where I was moving, you know, it was just on the lookout for something that I could afford. That's a phenomenon that we see in formerly industrial working class neighborhoods across the city, is a kind of, you know, like, the vacancy rate is very, very, it's as close to zero as it can get without actually being zero in Montreal at the moment. But it's even worse for family-sized apartments, right? So, like, people who are on 1 or 2 incomes looking for a place with 3 or more bedrooms is, like, basically impossible. And a lot of those types of apartments are occupied by students who are living in roommate situations. As I learned about gentrification and sort of working-class displacement over the years, for a long time I was, like, I would describe myself as sort of like a self-hating gentrifier, you know, like, and I was very much sort of insisting on kind of like the cultural elements of gentrification and the sort of alienation that, that new bars and restaurants and kind of even more underground, like, show spaces and whatnot, the impacts, the sort of rippling cultural impacts that has on working class neighborhoods. But, you know, the more that I actually was involved in struggle around the issues, the more I realized that it was, you know, those were largely sort of secondary phenomena, that in fact it was, you know, it's about capitalist restructuring of space. And I came to see that it's not necessarily about, you know, what type of poor or middle income person you are, or, you know, where you move or how long you live there, but about, you know, how you relate to struggle in the space that you're living. I've come to be, like, much more forgiving, I guess, of student populations over the years because of that.
Yeah, I remember speaking with some people. So I used to live in Crown Heights in Brooklyn, which experienced a lot of rapid gentrification. I also lived in the Kensington neighborhood of Philadelphia, same story. And in both cases, it's where I could afford to live, but then I ended up really loving it and also getting somewhat involved. And a lot of what they would talk about is, like, it wasn't an issue that there was another wine bar. The issue was that you could only afford to have a wine bar. You couldn't afford to put in a laundromat. You couldn't afford to put in a, like, grocery store or a Depp that had, you know, anything but, like, the finest cheese. And so it wasn't really that there were more of these things. It's that they stood for having less of just, like, these basic necessities. And I think that's a good, like, kind of contrast. I also think about it too, is, like, so for me personally, I'm, like, the child of industrial workers, right? So when my family was pushing me to, like, go to college and basically make this monster that had to live in these urban areas, like, they did so out of their own anxiety to not have me struggle the way they did. And I wonder if you saw that in some of the people you spoke to, or even kind of felt that yourself.
I interviewed people from, I guess I would say, across the sort of socioeconomic spectrum or the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. You know, I wasn't necessarily interviewing people living in sort of the ultra-rich condos along the canal. But, you know, there are a variety of perspectives on gentrification, even within people who are negatively materially affected by it. Some people are very much like, you know, that I don't recognize the neighborhood. Like, you know, there is that kind of cohabitation issue, you know, of, you know, like I walk down the street and I don't meet anyone I know anymore. And like, there's crowds outside of all these new restaurants and they don't let you pass by. Other people were like, so this is not what I would have preferred, but at the same time, you know, like, things change and, you know, we kind of have to, get adapted to that. But, that was more about, as I said, about the sort of like, I don't know, the secondary layer of impacts, the kind of cultural, manifestations of gentrification that are lived out in basically like the commercial offers. So as you say, you know, it's like, is it going to be a wine bar as opposed to a diner? And those are, you know, those are very important distinctions, obviously. You know, I interviewed one woman who's lived her whole life in the neighborhood, and she'd say, there's nowhere I can go anymore, and just like order a coffee and a bowl of soup and, you know, hang out and talk to people. And now, like, there's all these restaurants that, like, I go in them because I'm kind of curious to see what they're selling. But, like, you know, they sort of look me up and down and, you know, don't take me seriously, and I can't go in there. And that's real. But I think, like, everybody that I talked to from across a variety of backgrounds was very unanimous that, you know, the problem is actually in the housing market itself. And it's in the conversion of formerly rental space to privately owned, so the conversion to condominiums and new build construction, and the Southwest and Saint-Henri, Griffintown, Pointe-Saint-Charles, and Little Burgundy are areas that have been heavily impacted by massive new build construction. So in, you know, in other neighborhoods in the city, if you take like a place like Petite Patrie or Little Italy, it's much more about conversion of pre-existing rental stock to condos. But really in Saint-Henri, in the kind of post-industrial or de-industrialized landscape of having a lot of buildings available without an immediate vocation, there was a mass rush of real estate capital into that space, and a sort of an intentional political and economic restructuring of the space.
Yeah, I mean, that also goes into the names that they're giving, right? Like, you know, what is the Quartier du Canal like?
Yeah, the Quartier du Canal is like the new is the new business association along Notre Dame, and it's very much about you know, renaming space to reflect its new sort of wealthy profile. So you get people who live in some of the luxury condos along the canal, which, you know, it's like an apartment that you'd be able to buy for $800,000 or $1 million.
Only.
Yeah, only, you know, like, because that's, everybody's just got that cash lying around. And, you know, if you ask them, they won't say, you know, I live in Saint-Henri. They say, I live on the canal. You know, because there's a certain kind of prestige associated with that, and they have like a private access to the water. One of the other impacts we see happening along that, in that kind of naming and claiming sort of way, is the extension of the name of Griffintown, which has kind of come, you know, the it neighborhood in the city, and which was actually the starkest example of the kind of capital reinvestment of space, because big sections of the neighborhood had already been evicted for the construction of the highway, you know, about 20 years earlier. So there was sort of, you know, a kind of a mass concerted development all at once of mega developers. But now, like, if you're looking for apartments to rent in the Southwest, you'll see that landlords are calling everywhere at Griffintown. So, you know, you'll find like a 3.5, which, you know, for those of you not in Montreal, is a one bedroom apartment for $1,500 a month, and it'll say Griffintown, but actually it's in like the west end of Saint-Henri, you know, which is, if you're like me and you have short legs, it's like a good hour and 20 minute walk, you know.
It's kind of a hike. It's interesting to see which neighborhoods expand, right? Mm-hmm. Which ones contract under that. So sometimes what I talk about in my old neighborhood is I would say, well, if you live here, we call it this. But if you're a real estate agent, they're calling it this,
totally,
right?
Totally. I mean, in Montreal, like, we have the phenomenon of the neighborhood called Mile X, which is the kind of Marconi-Beaumont former industrial sector between the Mile End and Little Italy. And Mile X is like not, it's a name that was entirely created by developers. Like, it's not, it doesn't have any sort of organic life. But these things get taken up partially because, you know, like the people who had lived there for a long time get pushed out because of conversion. And then like people buying apartments will, you know, think, okay, so I bought a place in Mile X and there must be a neighborhood named Mile X. And then, you know, they're sort of creating a social and cultural life in a space called Mile X. And then, you know, 10 years later, Mile X exists, right? It's a very disturbing and quick phenomenon.
Yeah. It's very interesting. You just turn around one day and like the neighborhood actually is there because we've been using it mm-hmm. enough as a term.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I was thinking about with your work doing this oral history, but also kind of having this identity as a community organizer as well, do you think people spoke to you differently in your interviews because you approached them as a oral historian than they might have? Or did you see any difference in those interactions if you're essentially like speaking to a pretty similar group of people?
Most of the people that I interviewed are people that I have known for a long time, either in the context of, you know, being neighbors in the in Saint-Henri or being involved in like housing struggles together. So there's a very real sense, I think, in which people were just kind of like, okay, this is my friend and I'm like helping him with his homework, you know, which is, you know, it's accurate. It's not... So I'm not sure that by and large people kind of were relating to me as an academic first and foremost. Although that, you know, that is absolutely the underlying like material relationship, right? Because like obviously in oral history practice, like we're not paying people to participate in the interview because that kind of, well, that creates strange dynamics as well. But, you know, we are creating a product together, myself and my interviewees, which then materially benefits me, right? Because I have a doctorate and, you know, I guess the state of the job market is not that great. So it maybe doesn't materially benefit me immediately, but it, you know, there is a very big difference between someone who moves through the world with a PhD and somebody who moves through the world who hasn't gone to university, you know, and that's I think that's one of the real sort of material contradictions at the heart of oral history work. And also it was just kind of hard for me, I would say, to kind of wear that historian's hat. I was a bit embarrassed, you know, to be like coming into a space that I had related to as an organizer, as a resident of the neighborhood, as a university affiliated person, you know, and I think for better or for worse, you know, you sort of have to assume what you are because it doesn't help anybody to play make believe about it. But I would say it more impacted my own feeling of awkwardness than it did the way that people were necessarily relating to me.
Yeah. How do you move past that?
The feeling of awkwardness?
Yeah.
I don't know if you do. I'm not sure it's the worst thing. You know, it's a, you know, there's like in as people who do oral history know there's an infinite literature about, you know, kind of creating egalitarian relations in this dialogic space of the interview. But I also think like there being a sharp awareness of everybody involved of the power differentials is really important. So I don't think you should go into it kind of in a sense of total comfort. Yeah. On the other hand, like I, you know, as people who I've known for a long time, right? So often the interviews, like I'm a little bit embarrassed about the moment when they become archived and like people are going through and they realize, oh, they're actually just talking to each other the whole time. Like it's not necessarily like I ask a question and the person talks and then I ask another question and the person talks. It's very much like a back and forth, which was great, I think, for the kind of relational space of the interview. But I'm not sure it was the most professional thing, but that's probably not that important anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also it's like, even if it's not professional, it's still kind of exposing and cataloging this period of time, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's an authentic reflection of the relationships that I was working from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in your writing, you also mentioned kind of having this impatience with academia's idea of what might address issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there was any period in your interviews or just kind of in yourself where you've been trying to reconcile that feeling of like, doing history that is aligned with mm-hmm. activism versus like actually like helping and like working in a community.
Yeah, I mean, I started my PhD actually a little over a decade ago. Like I did a year and a month roughly, and then I quit because I had a sense of, you know, kind of urgency about political work that. That being an historian was not responding to. And then I went and did other organizing work for a long time and eventually kind of came back to the more reflective space because there were things that I was seeing, you know, in the course of organizing that I was not really able to kind of come to grips with, or, you know, get a handle on. And so I reinvested that intellectual space without being like kind of romantic about it, I think, because it's important that, you know, like professions in general are really have as a significant feature that they can give you the feeling of doing really important work while actually doing work that like shores up the system, right? So, you know, if you're like a public defender or a legal aid lawyer, you're like, you think of yourself as like fighting the fight for social justice, but like all of your work is supporting the existence of the prison complex. And you know, if you're an oral historian, we think of our work as really, you know, kind of breaking down the barriers between the researcher and the researched giving space for people to talk about their experience. But, you know, at the same time, we're like participating in the grant cycle and the university complex, which is, you know, the sort of commodification of knowledge and in many ways spaces of exploitation, both of students and of the variety of people who work in the university. So I think it's important to like think about, be trying to do good work without having illusions about the institution. Mm-hmm. When I was doing my own work, I was trying to, you know, create things that would be relevant to struggle. So there was a couple different things that I worked on, like non sort of dissertation form outputs. I made a little documentary film about 50 years of tenant struggle in the Southwest, an audio walk, a sort of a downloadable audio walk about issues around gentrification and property destruction and other forms of structural violence. And, you know, in general, I think that I just try to contribute with what I can as an oral historian, while recognizing that, like, what I'm bringing to the table as an intellectual is not always what's needed. You know, I think more we need to ask ourselves more. This is probably true of professionals in general, but definitely as sort of left intellectuals, you know, we have to ask ourselves more the question, what is to be done, and like less the question, what it is that I would like to do. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes what I'd like to do corresponds well, you know, other times it doesn't, right? Because like other times maybe what's needed is like looking after kids so other people can go to a meeting, or doing the dishes, or like, I don't know, participating in an occupation, like all of the things, right, that make up a movement. So yeah, I think it's just it's being kind of humble about what it is that, you know, the historian's skill set has to contribute and what it doesn't, you know?
Yeah. So like, you know, at the most very basic terms, it's like recognizing that like you're also doing a job and also, you know, a worker in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also love what you're saying about like the ways you can contribute and like childcare. And I am kind of, I think, constantly haunted by this idea of like why I am here and other people are not.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like maybe from an amount of humility of being like, I don't know if I'm the smartest person I know that's like going to school. Like, I don't get it. But I think it's an interesting way to just kind of look at and remind ourselves, like, even if someone's not here, like, how can we help them to be?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or also saying that, like, this isn't maybe the only way to have a voice.
Totally. Yeah. And it's not the only way to do history either, right?
Yeah.
There's lots of really great historians in the variety of ways that people do historical practice, which often is through memory and kind of discussion and just sort of like general bullshit, you know, that is equally as important to kind of the role that thinking critically about the past can play in a social movement as you know, that the kind of academic professional historian can play in that space as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, is there any questions that I have not asked you that you would like to talk about or like that make you think of topics you would like to talk about more?
I mean, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot in terms of deindustrialization and deindustrialization studies is that it's heavily dominated by a certain paradigm, you know? So like in both, like, I guess in the Anglo-American world particularly, you know, we're very sort of like structure of feeling, Raymond Williams, E.P. Thompson, class culture. And, you know, I think my own work is absolutely in that mode, but we're not so good at explaining structurally what's happening, you know, like, so one of the things that I've been trying to think about is, you know, what are the mechanisms of cycles of capital accumulation that lead to deindustrialization, and that, you know, place working class communities in the global north in relationship and in tension with their counterparts in the global south. And, you know, I don't have any conclusions about this, but I do think it's interesting that, you know, it's like certain parts of Marxist theory get super mobilized, those that deal with culture and ideas, and the ones that deal with like political economy are not so much part of the deindustrialization studies canon. So it's, I don't know if it's a question or a plea, but I feel like you know, we all need to be like pushing back on that and moving into political economy. So that, for the people doing deindustrialization studies who might listen to this podcast, I just want to say I'm trying, and I feel like we should all try.
Yeah, a plea or a challenge, maybe.
Yeah,
like,
maybe.
Oh, it's a challenge.
A friendly challenge.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. So I feel like we're pretty good. I know that there might be some people that have questions on the Zoom.
I do see Tom has his hand up. Tom, if you'd like to jump in.
Tom.
Yeah, should I speak it or should I type it?
Oh, we can hear you. It's so cool.
Okay, so I'd love it if Fred could expand more on that kind of last meditation. I'm someone who's been similarly frustrated by the absence of political economy from the industrialization studies. And I know, Fred, you've had some interesting things to say about the shift in primary labor markets that is brought in neighborhoods like Santa Maria as a result of the industrialization. And I'd love if you could talk about that and its relationship to gentrification.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Tom, for the question. So in my own work, I think when in deindustrialization studies, when people tend to do sort of explanations for why things happen, it tends to be a lot about political decisions taken, you know, so the sense that like deindustrialization was not inevitable. Sorry, I'm not sure where to look. Tom, am I looking at you or am I? anyway, it's fine. Hey, there you are. Cool. Which is, you know, is interesting to kind of politicize and historicize the policy decisions that lead up to job loss and, you know, the lack of kind of support for modification of industry from the state or from the company itself. And you know that of course reflects what a lot of workers have to say about their experience, right? The company, you know, is still profitable. They just replaced this particular piece of machinery. It doesn't make sense that they shut us down. In ways that I think actually somewhat tend to obfuscate the broader dynamics of kind of, you know, falling rates of profit or over accumulation. That lead to sectoral switching, you know, like in the economy, that's really a lot of what happened in Saint-Henri, that there was a kind of an expansion of industrial production in the World War II and immediate post-war period, leading to like a glutting of the market and therefore a falling rate of profit, and then you know, moving to either the suburban space or to global south countries of a variety of the corporations that were along the Lachine Canal, and therefore a kind of restructuring of global labor markets. In which, you know, a section of the white settler working class was essentially sacrificed in order to facilitate this sectoral spatial switching of capital flows. And so, interestingly, in order to maintain like what sector of the industrial working class continues to exist in North America as kind of like the global aristocracy of labor, significant parts of that, which were, at least in Montreal, jobs that were heavily feminized, jobs that were occupied by migrant labor in a lot of cases, had to be sacrificed. And so you get kind of like in the first world labor market, you get this kind of disjuncture between the aristocratization of a small segment of union employees, you know, you can think about like auto workers, or for example, and like the total lumpenization of everybody working in sort of like secondary industries, so like plastics and clothing manufacturers, so like all of these things getting sent to Mexico, to China. And I feel like when we talk about gentrification, we tend to, especially in the Montreal context, where it gets mixed in with nationalism and national identity, we tend to talk about it as if we are like protecting these popular neighborhoods, these quartiers populaires, which are often sort of white-coated spaces, without thinking about like, what were the forces that led to our concept of a working class neighborhood essentially being like lumpenized white people, right? And you know, why do we apply the popular neighborhood label to a place like Saint-Henri and not Parc X or not Côte des Neiges? And in fact, you know, within the urban space, the sort of the sectoral shifting of capital is also like a move from global north labor to global south labor being in the global north. So you think about all the people working at like the Dollarama warehouses, and a variety of other sort of capital distribution centers that are actually, you know, everybody working there is working for an agency, right? So nobody's actually working for the company. So there is that like inbuilt precarization. All that to say that the sectoral switching of capital flows in the sort of late 70s crisis, and then the reconquering of space by real estate capital, and through public pension funds too, right? Like subsidizing real estate development in Montreal, the biggest culprit is the Fonds de Solidarité FTQ, which is like a labor fund, right? That funds condo development. All of these things are like part of a broader reorganization of global capital and a segmentation, both along a global division of labor and within the global space of the North. And so it's like things like this that I'm trying to kind of apply, you know, to both as the structuring force and as the explanation for a lot of the cultural things that we tend to focus on as oral historians and that I have focused on as well. And I think, I mean, my impression is, and maybe, you know, people will listen to this and think I'm, grossly exaggerating, but it's my impression that this is not like generally part of the explanations that we mobilize to explain deindustrialization as of yet. So thanks for the question, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Do we have any other questions from the Zoom? No? Well, I think we got one really good one, so I'm very happy about that. Great.
All right, folks, well, we really want to thank you once again for coming into Four Space to have this conversation. It was great to hear your exchange live and in person. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for that question, Tom. We really appreciate you jumping in. I'll just remind you that we did live stream this onto YouTube, so you can revisit any of the thoughts that were shared by Fred and Amanda here today. And of course, we will be taking this episode and re-releasing it as an audio-only podcast. We'll do our gentle, careful editing here at Four Space and release it across our channels, and Amanda will also be working from this recording to release it as a continuum in her series of podcasts. I think we're at, what did you say, Amanda? We're at number 7 or 8 now, so this is great.
Yeah, I believe so.
Awesome. Well, thank you again so much, and
thank you so much for joining us for the Depot podcast, and thanks again to Fourth Space for having us. If you want to find out more, please check out our Twitter at deindustrialpol. That's the word deindustrial with the letters P-O-L at the end. And please remember to like and review. It really does help people find our feed. And you can also find out more information about Depot at deindustrialization.org. Thank you so much and have a lovely day.